Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, January 19th, 2010, Carrboro Board of Aldermen regular business meeting. Before we begin our agenda, I just have, I think, one announcement that I've been asked to relate. Specifically, that the Orange County Human Relations Commission will be hosting a Human Relations Month kickoff event on Sunday, January 31st, which is, what is that? That's a week from this Sunday, is that right?
Yes.
From 3 to 5 p.m. at the Carrboro Century Center. The event will feature a panel discussion on healthcare disparity and housing, what it means to you. The panel is going to include Gary Bennett from the Harvard School of Public, or Duke University, formerly Harvard School of Public Health. Hayden Bosworth from the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Durham, and Alfie Breland Noble from Duke University Medical Center, and Cedric Bright, the staff physician at Durham VA Hospital. So that will be a week from this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Carrboro Century Center if you would like to check out the healthcare and housing discussion. Okay. Is there anyone here tonight who is here to speak on a matter that's not already on our printed agenda? Okay. If not, we will turn to the consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
All right. Item one is approval of the minutes of the previous meeting of January 12th. Item two is a request to set joint public planning public hearings and assembly of governments meetings for 2010. Item three is a request to adopt a resolution reissuing bond anticipation notes. Item four is a request to set a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to revise the review requirements associated with alternative building design approval. Item five is a certification of the Carrboro Fire Rescue Department roster. Item six is approval of developing timelines for implementing federally funded transportation projects.
I think there was one question on item five.
Yes. I have one on six.
Okay, let's hear the question on five real quick.
My question is, when reviewing the list, the roster, I noticed that there is one of the fire folk are retired.
There's a name listed there for name one listed. Firefighter who retired. Mr. Chief, can you address that?
Evening, Board. That's correct. There's several members on the roster that are all retired. Many of those were volunteers. Some of them are retired fire chiefs that served our community for many a year prior, and we keep them on until they pass away.
Is that what the R indicates?
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. There's your answer.
Thanks, Jim.
On that same topic?
Actually, yeah, but it's more of a comment, and it's not a criticism of anything the fire department does or the town does. It's just noticeable that when you look at the roster and you look where people live, mm-hmm. only six live in Carrboro, mm-hmm. which means that we're not really providing a place where people who have entry-level jobs can purchase a house or live and then think, well, you know, if I get married and have children, then I still can't afford a house where I work. And so I'm going to bring this up more when we talk about the transportation thing, but the planning board did a lovely job, so I'll let them address that. But it's just, it's a thing that I think we need to address at the Assembly of Governments in a more concentrated way. Mm-hmm. So that would be why I brought up the comment.
Okay. And what was the question on number six?
Just to restate, and so people at home or picking us up would understand, rescission, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Rescission means to take back, and that means that the monies that were allocated to North Carolina were taken back. Is that correct?
A big chunk of it.
And what is the reason for that? I think people should know, because there was supposed to be all this stimulus money coming to North Carolina, and why was it rescissioned?
I'm going to ask somebody from planning to
in really clear lay terms, I think people need to know what.
Well, this is separate from the economic stimulus funding. It's just in the annual, in Congress's annual allocation of the budget for transportation funding.
Okay.
There was an item actually in the bill that had been there since 2005, I think, that they had acted on it every other year to continue funds that had not been spent or committed, and to basically carry over funds. And this year they decided not to.
But how could North Carolina afford to not use federal funds? What didn't happen?
Well, it's a timing issue to some degree. I mean, in our case, for example, the funds that we're looking at are our Greenway funds, and they were allocated to Carrboro. I think the first year was 2005, and we weren't ready to begin a process of planning, doing the conceptual planning for the Greenways. And we had asked for the money in two different fiscal years,
yeah,
for Bowen Creek and Morgan Creek, and we asked for money to do conceptual planning first and then to do construction following that.
Right.
And in 2005, we weren't ready to begin a conceptual planning process. We knew we had to set a process in place and figure it out and so forth. And we did embark upon, you may remember that we started the Morgan Creek Greenway planning process, mm-hmm, first. And then as that was just about ready to begin, there was a Greenway summit and sort of rethinking of how that process would take place. And then the Greenways Commission was established. And all of those things took months, you know, and months and it turned into years, essentially. And so in our case, just one example, I mean, sometimes it takes a while to get everything through the process. And in years past, those dollars had been carried over, essentially, continued. And so we haven't lost all of the transportation dollars. A portion of the transportation funding, though, that had not been yet committed or was beginning to be spent for projects was withheld.
Okay. Trish, if I may, at the MPO meeting last week, they looked at the impact of the rescission on all of the MPOs in North Carolina, and our MPO was in very, very good shape. I mean, when you looked at the planning and the budgeting and the process and how much we have spent, our MPO actually lost a very small amount of money compared to almost every MPO across North Carolina. I think one or two others may have been in better shape. And further, our TCC staff, in looking at everything we had going on, thought that there was going to be some kind of way to maybe make up most of the money by some projects that had come in under bid and some projects that were over budget. So I don't think the ultimate impact is going to be too terrible on our local MPO. And in fact, it really made our MPO look pretty good because we had spent and budgeted most of our money compared to a lot of other MPOs.
So
Other states besides North Carolina.
It was every state.
Right. Yes, they
are. It was affected by the situation, some more than others.
So there's nothing that North Carolina state government could have done differently to?
It was each MPO in their planning.
And they're responsible for. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So as a comment, not related to the municipality, but more of the federal, and it's kind of ironic that while they're providing stimulus funds, they're at the same time taking money away. So I'm wondering how significant the amount of money they're being able to provide for stimulus.
I guess just to point out the difference, that what they were doing is taking money away from projects that had
that were stalled out
and that had were supposedly going to happen but weren't really ready to go yet, and that's why the funding cycle was behind, and instead prioritize spending money on so-called shovel-ready projects. So, I mean, there is, just to point out, there is some logic to that.
And, in fact, the stimulus projects, if they're not kept on a very, very strict timeline and done, as we know, the way they're done, that's money we lose immediately, mm-hmm, too. So.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. Is there a motion for the consent agenda?
So moved.
All right.
Second.
All right. Moved and seconded. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passes unanimously. We are on to item C1.
Okay. This is a presentation by the Human Rights Center on wage theft, and I think there are representatives here who have a presentation to make to the board.
Thanks,
Good evening. My name is Rafael Gallegos. I'm the Associate Director of the Human Rights Center here in Carver and Chapel Hill. I'm also a student at the University of North Carolina. And we'll be using this PowerPoint. But basically, what I'm here is that is to tell you a little bit about what I have learned in the last 14 months at AbbeyCorps, which is a community that is located right where Davie Road and Jones Ferry Road meet. And so this is a community that has, as you know, struggling financially, and there's a lot of the people that live in AbbeyCorps, as some of you may know, some of them look for employment across the street in this corner, which is in front of the gas station. And nowadays, I think you will find on any given day about 50 people. And so one of the things that, you know, after spending there almost 14 months and talking to most of them, one of the things that they keep talking about is the fact that a lot of the people, or many of the people that hire them for, you know, day job, or sometimes even for jobs that are longer than that, is that, you know, sometimes they don't get paid. And there are instances where, you know, they work for over a month, and sometimes they don't get paid for anything. And so there are no venues other than, you know, going through the Department of Labor, which some of you may know, it's quite understaffed, and, you know, they're located in Raleigh. So to ask them to come here and sort of investigate some of these complaints that we place on behalf of the workers, it takes time. Sometimes, you know, those cases are not investigated. And so we felt that, you know, after hearing some of the stories, and not just about the hardships that, you know, not getting paid imposes, whether, you know, you're not able to pay for rent and, you know, provide food for your family, but also, you know, the psychological impact that also has on people, in that sometimes when they talk to me and they sort of begin to question their humanity in a way, in that, what is it that, I mean, they don't pay for what I do? And what is it that, you know, it's so hard for them to just to do the right thing? And so I have conducted a project and a research, some of the latest literature on day labor. And one of the academics that is at the forefront is from California. And he has a nationwide survey. And he interviewed over 12,000 day laborers across the nation. And it was over 200 sites. And one of the things that he, one of the things that in most of the published articles that he has done, is that wage theft is one of those problems that most of the workers, you know, talked about, because imposes a lot of hardships on you know, in their lives. And one of their in the policy and the recommendations, if you see on the first page, I think is the first point after the first on says improving enforcement of labor and employment laws. One of the recommendations is that, in addition to having this federal agency which regulates labor law, which also, you know, whether you're documented or undocumented, you are protected under this law. But one of the things that they find is that because there's no way to enforce this locally, there's no way where these individuals can go and talk to someone about what happened. You know, a lot of these abuses continue. And one of the things that we're hoping is that, you know, through your assistance, is that see if there's a way that we can implement an ordinance in which, you know, those who decide not to pay workers can be charged perhaps with a criminal offense, or something that can push these employers to do the right thing. I mean, we're not asking anyone to go on a witch hunt, and we're trying to harm any company or construction company or anything. We're just trying to make them understand that it is not okay not to pay people for the work they do. And this is, although it seems like we're primarily advocating for immigrants, I mean, this is the case to protect most workers, because as the literature suggests, I mean, because of the way the economy has changed, contingent work has become more prevalent. So that means that there are more people that have to work, you know, on an hourly basis. They have to work on a temporal basis. And what that does is that it creates this informal economy in which there's no contracts, there's nothing for them to sort of find a way to get their grievances, you know, acknowledged and taken care of. And if you notice, in I think page number 4, at the bottom of it, it says, do you know where to report workplace abuses? And if you look under the SAL, which I highlighted, it seems like 67% of the people who they interview do not know. And one of the reasons they think this happens is because since there's no way where they can sort of go to someone with easy access, whether it be the police or some other body, you know, it's very hard for them to call the Department of Labor because, you know, there's a sense of fear because, you know, you're dealing with the government and you don't know what that might happen. Most of them don't understand that, you know, they are protected under the labor laws and that it is okay to contact them. And so we're hoping that, you know, we can maybe work with you all and see if there's a way that, you know, which we can help them because it's really hard to stand out in the corner, you know, and sometimes the weather is freezing cold. They have to work under really extreme conditions. And, you know, on top of that, you know, not getting paid, it's really hard. It really questions their humanity. I mean, they ask me, I mean, am I not a human being? Why is it that they're not doing the things that they do for other people? I mean, I just go to work just like anyone else, and I struggle, and I work hard, and still I don't have that security. And so we're hoping that, you know, with your help, we can perhaps find a way to make it right for them. I mean, like I said, we're not trying to go after anyone. We're just trying to protect those who have to endure these conditions of labor. And this is something that is, you know, increasingly growing. This is something that's not going to stop. I mean, contingent work is growing. Mm-hmm. And so to find a way to maybe protect the residents of Carrboro would be maybe a good way to, maybe through this would be a good way to start. Yes.
I thank you for this and for bringing clarity to an issue that was a little too broad the first time it came. I did have one issue with your PowerPoint, and we don't have to go through your PowerPoint. The police force in Carrboro, I kind of don't like their being stereotyped any more than any other people like being stereotyped. We have a great police force, and there are good people on that. And I think if you look at this town's history with Abbey Court, are you aware of our history with Abbey Court? The help that the town has given to the residents, yes, of Abbey Court, and that includes the police officers. And it's not fair to paint our police force with kind of a broad brush of people doing profiling and who won't listen. And in Carrboro, our police do not check immigrant status. And so I think it would be very helpful if your organization would make sure that your clients and the people you're working with understand that, because that's a great step towards helping. That said, I think that this board is very much behind what you're trying to do. I don't know what kind of laws we can pass. I think our attorney would, you know, so how do we help to enforce like existing laws and the state law would be what we would need to come up with.
I didn't see the point you're referring to in the PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can just help me.
Yes.
I mean, I agree with your, you know, the comments you're making about the police force, but I didn't see any, you know, implicit.
Well, the South has the weakest labor laws. They also do not have strong law enforcement to protect workers' rights. Instead, the South's law enforcement is highly focused on illegal immigration, which has caused a great deal of racial profile and discrimination and abuse towards the Hispanic community of the South.
Okay.
That certainly is not fair to say.
I think that's true about some communities.
That is true about some. It's very unfair to say about our police force.
Agreed. Thank you.
I think that's a great point. And I think that one of the reasons why you have such a thriving community in Carrboro is because most people understand that Carrboro, in a way, is a haven. You know, they understand the protection that they get, you know, as opposed to being in Cary or Raleigh, perhaps. So, and most of the people that I talk to, I mean, they are aware of the benefits of being here.
I know that. I'm just saying, so please watch things like this publicly, because it sends a message about our police force, that our police force has been trying for many, many years to not be. So anyway, I don't want to get off on that red herring. I just ask, please don't go saying that publicly. It's just not fair to our police department. And I think we do want to help. It would simply be, you know, how can we structure things so that we can help? And I would refer that to our attorney.
I don't know if you're looking for a detailed response right now, although we've been talking to the district attorney's office, to the Department of Labor, and doing some research on our own because we knew the wage theft issue was coming up tonight. And there are some things that if we want to go into a detailed discussion, I think the board is really thinking about adopting an ordinance that would criminalize wage theft. We probably ought to go into a closed session and discuss that at some time, because there are some pretty significant legal issues that we would need to discuss as a board before we go forward.
Well, if you were somebody who felt that your wages had been stolen, what law, what state law would protect you, and who would you go to without having to go to Raleigh and go through a formal?
There are plenty of federal and state statutes that cover the situation. The problem is those statutes don't criminalize wage theft. There's all kinds of civil remedies that are available under the statutes. And the broad coverage of the statutes on the issue of the employer-employee relationship is one of the things we would need to discuss in terms of the town's authority to step in and to start regulating in the area.
So if somebody stole $2,000 worth of your labor, so the dollar amount wouldn't matter?
Well, can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
I think because we don't have anything in front of us,
right,
it might be helpful if we refer it to staff on this particular issue and get a report back.
Yeah.
I
think you're right. I worked very briefly in the labor section at the State Department of Justice. We were just talking about that earlier today on a different point. But and I would say the kinds of cases that we tended to investigate involve people who have worked 50 hours a week for the last year and have not been paid overtime ever. So that with the result that it's, you know, days and days and weeks of back pay that they're due. The amounts of money at stake are sometimes very large. Whereas what the kind of situation he's talking about, what people tend to be burned on is, you know, a day's labor, maybe a week's labor, which I'm not trying to minimize their suffering, but in terms of absolute dollars, you know,
that's not the way to go about it.
I mean, I guess that, you know, the labor section has some way of prioritizing the cases, and it probably has to do with, you know, what's perceived to be at stake in the in the particular case. But it is a real problem for sure. So there was a motion, I think, to refer this to the staff for them to report back to us. It's been seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed.
And can we notify them so that they can come back? Maybe we'll have it sort of like a work session after we meet with our attorney in closed session. Cause that would be my suggestion, because that would make it more effective.
Also, the Central Latino closed recently, and so maybe this would be an opportunity to seek engagement with whatever follow-up is needed. My understanding was that this month they were supposed to come together, the board, and talk about their future. So if James Harris, I guess, would be the person to, from staff or Steve.
Just to help us understand what's happening.
Yeah, to let us know.
Just talk with Bob.
To follow up, El Centro Latino, that closed 2 months ago now.
Right.
Just to make sure that the town knows what the status is with them.
In other words, the organization still exists on paper. So, and what is happening with them? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Item D2, a discussion of Owasso draft long-range water supply plan update.
There's no staff presentation. This is really boards.
Okay. Well, who wants to dive in?
Well,
that was funny.
So basically, we have two representatives from Carrboro to the Owasso board, and
they're here with us tonight.
Okay, great. And I guess we want to know what their position is, considering the stand that we took through our resolution recently, whether the town of Carrboro will be represented with the Owasso board.
Would either of you guys like to comment on the situation?
Can we both come up? And
just Yeah.
That'd be great.
So, I'm less inclined to, you know, say, well, this is what I think right now. I think we're here to answer questions that you have or concerns. I mean, is there a particular...
Well, I don't think we have questions. Okay. I think we have, as a matter of policy, that the town of Carrboro is opposed to this notion of purchasing water before declaring a water supply shortage. Mm-hmm. And you guys are our delegates to that board, and we would, you know, so I think the thinking at this table, I don't want to speak for everyone, is that you would represent, you know, in the rare case where we actually, as a matter of policy, take a position on something Owasso is doing, that you guys would be inclined to represent that. And if you're not inclined to do so, I think that it would be incumbent on you to let us know and kind of let us know what your disagreement is, okay, and then we can proceed from there.
Sure.
Does that make sense to you?
Yep, I captured it.
Okay. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, well, I was here when the resolution was passed. And I don't agree with the resolution because at this point, in 2002, we were pumping 10.5 million gallons of water a day to our customers. As today, we're projected to pump 4.7, but with reclaimed water coming on, we're going to be somewhere around 6.4 million gallons a day. When you look at that in forms of dollars and our rate structure, what that is doing is bringing down the amount of money that we have available to us. We also stand a great chance in the next 5 to 10 years that we won't be in this position because university is going to be vastly increasing that reclaimed water, bringing it online, which decreased the amount of water that we're going to have available, which will be increasing the amount of water that we'll have to save and won't be in the position that we were in a year ago or 2 years ago. And our rate structure will kind of stay the same. We had this big hit of 17% a couple of years ago, projected to be that for the next 5 years. What we said to our staff is, look, you guys got to go in here and go right down to the bones, cut this down, see what we can do to bring it under that, because we can't do that. And we did a good job. We brought it down to
975.
We projected to be there for the next 5 years. What we did was pushed our programs back, especially changing our water meters, doing root control. We haven't done any root controls in the last 3 years, hoping to get this budget under control. And with the position that you're taking, you're telling us that we don't think you're doing a good job, which in fact, we will not be going out buying water until we are put in a very poor position. And we don't see that we're going to be in that position.
In other words, not until it's a water supply emergency.
See, my problem is that I don't see if what we're saying is we're saving a lot of water already, and because we're not selling that water, we're having a problem with the budget. One thing that we are gaining is increased capacity virtually, in that we don't need to expend millions and millions of dollars to increase our capacity by...
We won't be seeing that.
We won't be seeing that. So
until 2035.
Exactly. So we're saving a lot of money, actually, by all the saving that the community has done through the times when there have been droughts, which from this graph I have here happened to be in, there's two droughts, 2001, 2002, and 2007,
right.
And that's kind of where the drop-off happened, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so it changed the way in which the community uses water, and it also saved us millions of dollars of not having to increase our capacity.
But you have to remember, at that same time, the other communities were hurting, and we were 40% better than they were.
That's right. And the money that
We're conserving as much as we can.
And also, your point's a good one, Sammy, that we don't have to spend that money to increase our capacity, but that money that we're saving, you know, is saved against the day when we are going to have to spend some money to increase capacity. There is going to come a time in 2035 when the quarry is empty, and that will become our final reservoir for water. And at that time, we're good to go. In the meantime, there are a couple of measures that we're taking just to ensure a steady and least expensive supply of water that we can. This is one of them. We are part of a partnership working on allocating the Jordan Lake water also. And in 5 or 7 years, that will be set up, and there will be automatic triggers in all of the participating towns and agencies, Apex and Morrisville and Raleigh and whatnot, that will direct Jordan Lake water to folks who need it. And then after that, we will have the quarry. So there's a series of steps that are in place to increase our capacity. But for the time being, even that money that we're saving, we're being stressed to just pay the bills. You know, we have a bond that we have to pay. We have chemical costs and whatnot. There have been 12 positions frozen at OWASA. The CIP, the active budget, capital improvement plan, several things have been frozen or put off, like Braxton was saying. So OWASA is economizing hugely. But the fact remains that we need to do everything we can to save customers money. See, if we go into a stage two or a stage three emergency, what happens is there's a graduated rate structure. So depending on how much you use, your rates go up. Now, right now, people have peeled back. I mean, they have wrung out their use, if you will. The 2001 drought, and then 7 and 8, people really cut back. I mean, the conservation has been extremely successful. So people are pretty much locked in at the level of use where they are, or pretty close. So what looms is an increase in rates when we go to a new stage of emergency. And that pressure, that financial pressure, is downward. People with limited income, fixed income, it's going to be harder for them. So this is actually a cost saving measure for our users. This is a way, a tool that we have to keep the water costing as little for as long as possible. So
yeah, I understand that.
Mr. Salmon, that curve is not coming back up.
The demand.
So then,
that demand curve
is there
is not
really an
back
issue
up.
For there to be a drought, considering that we are going lower and lower, and that the
highly
current
unlikely.
Reservoirs.
Highly
so
unlikely.
Would it not make more sense for this decision to be made in the future, when the people who are living at that time are closer to the time to make that decision? Whereas, if we make that decision now, you know, we're doing it for the likelihood of it happening in the future.
Or just the possibility of it happening. And this is just part of a 50-year plan. You know, it's a long-range water supply plan. And so I hear what you're saying. And there's two things about that may address a concern you've got about, you know, that we're locking people in 2017 into something they may or may not want to do. OWASA has been very good, in my opinion, at transparency. So as we look out, if it looks like there's going to be a chance that we would want to go to another municipality and ask for some water, we're going to announce that. And so people will have it. What?
We have to come to them first.
Okay. And, well, we have to come to you, too. I
we have to come to you first.
Which, yes, which is current policy.
Okay, right. Great. So we'd have to do that anyway. And so there's that mechanism. But there's another thing that I think is important, and it's a little bit more of a principle. We are involved with other towns and counties right now in developing this watershed plan for water management. The Jordan Lake project is one of them, and there's some others. So that collaboration is key. I mean, that is the wave. We've got to be a bigger unit, you know,
why?
Watershed unit, not a town unit. That's town's arbitrary.
Why is that key?
Because what it does is it maximizes the resources in a larger area, so that if somebody's, you know, needs some water, there is infrastructure set up to get it to them. I mean,
I think that's like one of the things is like we have, as a small government, a control over our local resources.
Mm-hmm.
My perspective is, I don't know about the rest of the board, but I like the idea of that control locally. And as much as we're more dependent, interdependent, connecting our water systems with all these other systems, we lose that autonomy. And it's already, you see it with all kinds of collaborations that we do with our neighboring town and the university, where we have a small representation. I mean, even with OWASA, we're a small representation on the board, mm-hmm. and what we get to say is very small. So imagine when we are at the triangle scale, and then Carborough itself has that much less say in its water security or transportation security.
Well, I suppose that could happen, but it's unlikely, I think, Sammy, because one of the reasons it's going as slowly as it is, developing a basin-wide plan, is that nobody wants to give up that autonomy. So the agreement that is arrived at is not going to, you know, paint us into any kind of corner. It will simply be a set of possibilities that are legally supported and that have the infrastructure in case it's needed.
I always may call it a slippery slope.
Well, we don't give up that
towards what?
We don't give up that autonomy like that. Mm-hmm. We still have to come back to the three governing bodies to ask you to do that.
So we
still have a chance to get in. We just can't do it on ourselves, by ourselves. We always have to come back and ask the governing bodies.
But I also wonder, though, a slippery slope towards what?
Towards what I just described, the control and limiting your growth to your local capacity.
That won't be given up. But what will be gained is access to resources if they're needed. And it exists now. We have sold water to Durham. They have sold water to us. Like Braxton said, last year we had conserved a lot more than other towns. So when they needed it, we sold it to them. And in practice, that's what happens now. If for some reason we, with a very much smaller watershed than Durham, should need some water, we do 30-day or 90-day agreements. And so in a way, it's just, it's kind of, to me, it seems like a bit of a common sense. If you've got a big area of towns that in many ways are connected geologically, then it makes sense to try and figure out ways in which they can help one another. And I don't see it right now as becoming dependent or losing control of anything that we would want to control. We've done a very good job at controlling our use. And so, again, the likelihood of us needing to do this is low. But if we need to, and if we have the opportunity to do it before we raise rates that hurt our customers, it just seems to me like a useful tool to have.
Everybody has something to say. Will you all forgive me if I just jump in for just a second and say...
Randy, will you forgive him?
I think I can.
Randy, well, I will.
I think part of the issue, though, is that getting some clarity about how often we might anticipate that this kind of situation might arise. In principle, these types of water shortages are very infrequent. Mm-hmm. Although it happened twice in the last decade, but in principle, we don't think that they'll come up very often. And I guess the essential problem is that as I understand the proposal, the way it is now, what you're saying is when let's say like 2% of the time, when we run into a water shortage situation, mm-hmm. OWASA would go and buy that water from Durham or whoever, and the people of Chapel Hill and Carver, the customers of OWASA, would never feel the impact of that.
I don't know about never, but okay. Well, it would mitigate it.
Well, I guess the point being, though, I think what this board is ultimately concerned about is the notion that we could get down to that we could be consuming water as a community at a rate which pushes us into that situation, and the proposal here doesn't give those citizens who are consuming lots of water any real feedback on what they're doing.
See,
from an environmental point of view.
Well, I'm not sure about that, though.
That rate structure, really, Mark, was going to prevent that. I mean... Our customers who were up here at between $200 and $300 a month are dropping down now to maybe $100, and we're seeing them staying there.
Right.
And with reclaimed water coming on, the university is going to accelerate that move, and we're still going to have more water available, less funds, because we're going to, you know, we're not selling that volume now.
The difference is... between what we, or I don't want to speak for the board, what I would like to see the citizens know and not be invisible to the citizens.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. As you said, the conservation worked really well, and all of us are
working. It's definitely working.
Right, and we're it's a lifestyle change many of us. And that's wise, because it makes it sustainable. Yeah. If the water purchase is made when the need is there without alerting the public, then the public is being fooled into thinking that their water use is sustainable, and it's not. That's the issue, at least for me.
Okay, now I'm glad you said that, Randy, because I'll have to.
I'm saying in terms of there's no feedback to the customer.
Well, okay.
I mean, to the community that hey, we are. This is a crisis.
So far,
that there's something wrong here when we get to this situation.
Got it. I mean, it's a fairly long document, so perhaps that language isn't in there and needs to be clarified. But when I think back to the 2007 and 2008 drought, we made constant announcements. There were constant public meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were really getting down to it, you know, the green industry came out in droves, because they were worried. Now, we did have to go to stage three for a short time. As soon as we could, we came off stage three and did it sooner than we had thought, specifically because there were livelihoods at stake here. So, I mean, if clarifying the language would work, I think that wouldn't be hard to do.
Well, it's language and it's also the process, because mm-hmm. I thought each step of the way and being alerted and mm-hmm. using the website and
yep.
and all of those, even though that was happening at the same time that the situation was happening, mm-hmm. I think it was effective.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, now with hindsight, you know, I would use that as almost a model for this is how you keep the people engaged and
right.
you keep them aware of what they need to do so that they see water as something that needs to be protected every step of the way. So.
Well, thanks. I guess I was sort of assuming that as I read the language of this proposal, only because that's what we did in fact do, as you pointed out. So what I meant by clarifying the language was being really clear about what the process is, and that just as I've been very impressed with OWASA in my 4 years on the board, the transparency is total, as far as I can tell. Everything we do is open to the public, and there are certainly members of the public that show up, and it's great. So there are warnings that will be there all the way along, and there will be warnings before we go to stage one that there's an issue here, hello, people, and then, well, you know, it's still not raining. You guys are doing a great job, but we need to go to number two. Hello? So before we would even go to anything like a purchase and sale agreement with Kerry, there would have been two or three shifts in regulation alerting people that more conservation was necessary. Now, I think we tightened our belts or squeezed our use so tight in 2007 and 8 that it yeah. wasn't people overusing the resource. It really wasn't. At that point, it just wasn't raining.
Exactly.
So there's not much you can do about that, except if you've got a water... A river shed right next door that for some accident has a little bit more water, and their own regulations allow for a sale, we wouldn't be putting anybody else in any kind of hardship.
Right.
Well, it makes sense to just
right.
go there.
Right. I don't think that's the question. I think it's because
right.
the way it says, you know, about recommended in the future the OWASA purchase water before declaring.
Okay.
That's in number on page 17. There.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think this board mostly pretty much agrees with how you just stated that a moment ago.
Okay.
But that we don't see it.
Okay.
In
that's
that
right.
plan.
Right.
And that I think is the essential.
Yes.
That plus whatever
well,
Dan's about
I mean,
to say.
I think
is that in the plan? I mean, how?
Yeah.
How
yeah.
can the board be assured that that's?
Well, I mean, first of all, look at what we did in 2007 and 8. And secondly,
but you didn't have this language in 2007, right?
No, but our actions spoke volumes, Dan, because we were out front with everything, saying, "Hey, guys, you know, you're gonna have to cut back."
Well, I think the language is. I think what now we're saying
need,
is the language of the plan needs
some
to change.
Of the language,
right.
you know.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to try and. I don't think we're proposing to. Wordsmith it right here, but the point of the resolution
yep.
before was driving it at just that issue, if I'm not mistaken.
That's interesting. Okay.
I also want to just throw this out right now
okay.
because I think having both of you here, I want to thank you for all of your work. Cause
oh,
like,
yeah.
Man, I know it's hard.
I love it. I really
you
do.
Have to, yeah. I think it's great.
It's so cool.
So I want to thank you for that, but I also want to tell you how valuable it is to have you here and have this kind of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could, if there's some way to make that more routine and rather proactive rather than reactive, I think that...
We'll come here so it's nice and good.
I've been somewhat remiss, Randy. I mean, I did, back in November, I just missed one. I know you guys were talking about water, and I spaced. So I'll just keep an eye, and when water's on the agenda... One of us will be here.
Can I just be clear? I'm not
yeah.
sure. I'm agree. Like what we're agreeing on. It
yeah.
currently says if sufficient water is available from other sources, it is recommended in the future that OWASA purchase water before declaring a water supply shortage, in order to minimize the inconvenience and potential hardship of additional use restrictions and rate surcharges on OWASA customers,
mm-hmm.
and to moderate the financial effects on OWASA.
Yeah.
So, how would you all see that language change?
Well,
we're going to let, why don't you send us a draft and we'll look at it, and we'll sit down and talk about
but
it.
But I get you, Sammy.
I do, too.
I'm not suggesting you didn't, but this part of the discussion was suggesting that we just needed to kind of wordsmith it or change the language so that it was clear that at every stage of the way the public was engaged, so that before any eventuality like this came about, everybody would have had every chance to do everything that they could to stave off this. But if it gets down to that, it would be what it says right there. It's just that we are going to put it off as long as possible, but if it comes to the point where that's what needs to be done to preserve our, to reserve some pressure on our customers and participate in a basin-wide partnership that we're developing, then we would do it.
Yeah, so I'm in disagreement of that for the reasons I gave before. I do think that people, if they know that this is not for real, as opposed to we have a backup once we do get really low.
That makes it not for real?
Well, I guess that's true. That clarifies it. So
give us some language. Give us some language that you'd like to see in, and we'll really look at it.
Well, I think you've got a problem with the principle of it. You know,
that's I don't like the lack of control. I mean, develop some language. We're at a board meeting, and
I'm not saying do it right now. I'm saying send us something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, we're receptive.
Okay.
I'm old-fashioned, I guess.
Guys, thank you. Thank you.
Mark, when my turn to speak?
Whenever you become more assertive than you already are, Dan.
I guess next time you jump in and say, may I go first, you get a different answer. So, couple things. First, if I understood you guys correctly, are you suggesting that we're already at the maximum conservation that the community can do?
No.
You're not? Okay.
I said that we have increased it.
Because I think that may be close to true in terms of routine, but I think, my perception during the drought is that people cut back a lot on all kinds of things that they don't routinely do, whether it's showers or toilet flushes or, things that were actually prohibited under the drought conditions, like watering and that sort of stuff, that was done. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but my question is, I really want to understand the point you're making about the cost to Owosso customers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that by buying water from a adjacent utility, a nearby utility, and selling it to our customers, that will save them money.
It will.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's an easier way to absorb the cost. And apropos Sammy's interest in control, here's a difference.
Well, let's focus on my question.
I want to answer your question, but he raised the issue of control, and that's what I wanted to say. We get more control over how long and to what degree our customers feel the cost, because if you put a restriction in place, stage 3 restriction, that puts more pressure on demand. Then, great, maybe we get to where we need to get, which we did in the 2007-8 drought. Okay, we lift it. Demand stays down. There's a wave. When you get that use down, it doesn't pop back up. And why is that important? The revenue doesn't pop back up. So you lose control for a longer time of how much revenue is coming in. When you buy it, it's sort of a one hit. There will be some effect, but it will be for a shorter time and, I think, to a lesser degree. But that...
Okay, but that doesn't answer my question, which is... Let's say I'm using 3,000 gallons of water.
Okay.
Okay. And the drought comes and I cut back to 2,000. But you have the opportunity to buy water from Durham so that I can still use 3,000. This is just hypothetical.
Okay.
basis, right? I mean, that's the idea, right? That you can sell me the water I would otherwise be conserving through additional conservation measures.
I guess, but, and I think I take your point, but the, in a way, it's a little, it misses one point. You, Dan, you know, can control your use, and that's fine, but we're talking about 80,000 people here.
But you're referencing it in terms of saving money for particular customers.
That's right.
Right? The customers will save money. And that's what I'm trying to understand is how I me being like every man,
right,
as a customer, by buying more water will save money over if I bought less under this plan.
I guess what I was trying to say is we charge in 1,000-gallon increments.
Right, I understand.
So there is
that.
Some wiggle room there. You could cut back a little more. So I really do understand.
Right, but in my example, so I cut back from 3,000 to 2,000. So I'm saving a 1,000-gallon increment.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm not paying for that $1,000 increment.
That's right.
Now, you may need to raise by rate if everyone's doing it to increase your cost.
Well, if everybody's doing it.
Right, but you're saying that, and this is what I'm not getting,
okay,
that if instead of my cutting back and saving the cost of that 1,000 gallons, if you bought that extra 1,000 from Durham and sold it to me,
mm-hmm,
that would save me money.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay,
so what am I missing?
Yeah.
I'm not going to confess that it's going to save you money.
Okay, so
well,
this
that's what I was claiming, though. So
yeah,
well,
I'm not
okay
claiming that.
Fair
so,
well,
so it's not been saved money to lots of customers.
I
got to
think about that some, Dan, because you're...
I would disagree all the time.
Well, I'll tell you what I think, because I think the fact is that for, and I may, you know, it's possible since I'm not in your seats that I misunderstand some aspect of the OASA budget, but I think there's a huge proportion of your costs, just like with town government, that are fairly fixed regardless,
right,
of the use.
Right.
And so you have to pay for those regardless of how much water is used. And so to recover those, if people are using less water, it means a higher rate.
Yes.
And it's not comfortable for OASA to raise rates because people look at that 17% number and they say, oh, my God. But the fact is that if 117% of 2,000 gallons a month is the same as 100% of 3,000 gallons a month, mm-hmm, then really the effect on the customer is the same other than there's a perceived increase. And I think so perhaps that we're not being really direct, unless I'm missing something, we're not really being direct about what's at issue here.
Okay. Well, I can, since I'm the only person that's been on the OASA board, one of the issues of how we sell water, you know, you sell water a certain volume and they compute that with your sewer and you get this total amount that you have to pay. And I was on the board from 92 to 99, and it was a constant complaint about the cost of water. Constant complaint. And it still is.
It still is.
About the cost of water for people who are on already a fixed and limited, mm-hmm, income. While we have this assumption that we are all moderately, if you will, employed and we are at a moderate income, Southern Orange County is increasingly seeing an increase in poverty because of the economy, because of taxes. I mean, sort of the same litany. And I don't always agree with OASA, and they know that. But on this issue, maybe the towns need to have a discussion of what is the price point between conservation and having water. We consider water to be something that you really need.
Mm-hmm.
You drink water, you cook with it, you wash your clothes, you bathe yourself. And so, I don't think we're going to solve this particular issue with just, and I don't disagree with our position, but I think there needs to be sort of a more community-wide discussion about what things cost. And OASA has big fixed costs. Chemicals always going up. The price of maintenance always going up. Paying for previous expansions, which previous boards and this current board, every time we vote in a subdivision, while we have the capacity, you still have to have a certain amount of capacity that the state requires. And so some of what you pay for when you pay your $55 for your 3,000 gallons a month is you are paying for capital costs.
74 now.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Mine was just 55, so you know.
You're good at conserving.
I'm trying. But, I mean, and that's the problem. That's been an ongoing problem since they created OWASA.
We have a fixed rate that's there no matter what happens. And what we've tried to do, what I've tried to do, is shrink that fixed rate a little so we can go out here and fix these water lines that we haven't touched in 3 years now.
Yeah.
Because of cost. There are other things that we've put off. Hey, I didn't even consider a raise for this man. It wasn't even on my calendar. It was for my employees, but not for the executives. Okay? And I'm hard on the budget, really hard, much harder than you guys. They were talking about 17 cents. I said, you know, I'm down here at 11.5. When you come down here, then we can talk.
There's a lot of 8-1 votes, I'll tell you that.
So we got them down to, I got them down somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, and we settled on 9.75, and that's where we're going to be for a while because of fixed rates. And we got debt service we have to do just like y'all do. And so, you know, the money is tough. And I don't let it go easily.
Joel, I really appreciate what you said, too. Much more clear than I was being. I kind of had my eye on the same notion of, this is what I was talking about, Dan, holding the cost where it is to the extent that we can. I didn't say it nearly as thoroughly or well as Joel did. But I was thinking about fixed income people, limited income people, people's other bills like grocery and gas and whatnot are going up. So if anything that we can do, I tend to try and go for it, you know.
They hear that from me.
But that still doesn't address my point that, I mean, it applies to low income or fixed income people just as well, that it's not clear that they're how you're buying water to sell them that they wouldn't use otherwise is to their advantage.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah.
But you know, implicit in my point is, you know, that there is a point that we haven't necessarily identified where there's, you know, it's a question of water for basic, what we consider basic needs.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone questions that if we know what that point is and we can buy water at that point, we ought to do so. But to buy water rather than continue our focus on conservation at a point when it's really more an issue of accounting doesn't, if that's what it is, I don't think it makes sense to this.
But Dan, you've seen more communities come back to our point of view with rate structure than you have over the last 5 years.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Raleigh, Durham are all going to rate structures now.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to ours, where we've been for the last last 10 years, I would say.
Yeah.
And they're finding out that they can't make their infrastructure work without increasing their rates because it's falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that unsustainable? Like infinite growth?
Yeah. It's going to happen. But this old structure that's already in the ground, that's breaking it, we're having to replace and pay for it. It is very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Dan, I think
very expensive.
Addressed your, and I know it.
I don't think we. Can I ask Ed Kerwin to speak
to this one point to see if he can settle it now? Otherwise, I will get back to you.
Why don't you get back to me?
Okay.
Yeah, because I don't think we.
Because we really wanted this to be a conversation with you guys. You know, we've heard from Matt on these issues.
Okay.
All right.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure, I'm serious.
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks,
guys.
Okay. Item D3, discussion of recommended revisions to the Chapel Hill and Carborough 2035 long-range transit plan.
We do have an update and a staff presentation for you all. Jeff?
Yeah, we should have them coming.
And Mark, when Jeff's done, I have some updated information from the transit partners meeting.
No.
So extra copies of the staff report that was distributed in the agenda packet that was distributed earlier today are in the front seat if you'd like to look at them. So this presentation is basically a summary of the staff report. The board directed staff to consider the various comments and input that have been submitted over the past several months and come back with a list of recommendations for revisions to the plan. So we're in that plan revision phase right now. Of course, Chapel Hill is going through that as well, and the university may have some recommendations as well. March 2010 is slated for the transit partners coming back and presenting a revised plan based on these recommended revisions, and then the various boards would consider the revised plan for adoption. So there are three basic recommended revisions in the staff report. And they pertain to topics that have received a lot of discussion in the public input process over the last several months. The topics are light rail transit in Carrboro, climate change and environmental performance measures, and parking and its relation to regional transit service. The first recommendation, with respect to light rail transit, there was significant discussion on this topic, there's been a long history of discussion in Carrboro around this topic. Provision of light rail service or another higher order transit service to Carrboro should continue to be analyzed in future transportation planning processes, including but not limited to an alternatives analysis for a major enhancement of transit service in the MLK corridor, MLK Boulevard corridor, and the 2040 long-range transportation plan that's developed by the MPO. So the staff is recommending that the plan include a recommendation that the light rail corridor, which was not included in the final service concept, be considered in future alternatives analysis. And there were several reasons why what the plan presented for why the light rail corridor was not included in the final service concept recommendation in the plan. The one was a lack of a direct connection with Carolina North. The plan discusses how at one point only transit service with a direct connection to Carolina North will be considered in the final service concept. The second is the plan's evaluation of corridors found that the light rail corridor, which is known as C5A in the plan, had relatively low ridership and relatively high capital cost. In general, light rail capital cost on a per mile basis is higher than bus service and bus rapid transit. So when you combine high cost with what the evaluation found was low ridership, that made it a less feasible alternative for the final service concept. And then a third reason that has been discussed over the past few months and certainly before that is the question of the use of the freight rail corridor. Obviously, there are considerations. There may be legal considerations. But of course, any use of the freight rail corridor would be predicated on an agreement with Norfolk Southern.
I kind of have a question. With this rail corridors, even to go to Chapel Hill, a lot of the rail corridor, at least the passenger rail corridor, is owned by the North Carolina Railroad, which is ostensibly owned by the people of North Carolina to the tune of about 90%. So I guess my question is, in the thinking of just the freight rail corridor, was there any thinking about using some of the North Carolina Railroad corridor?
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up. The North Carolina Railroad is conducting a feasibility study for commuter rail in the broader region, a region even bigger than, you know, just the Triangle region. And a component of that study will be analyzing the feasibility of commuter rail in the Chapel Hill-Carrboro area or through the Chapel Hill-Carrboro area. That study, they just selected a consultant in October, so that study is still ongoing. But that's something for everybody to keep an eye on.
Do you know when they're going to complete the study?
I think it could be by the spring, but it may take longer.
Okay. I would encourage us to comment about the study once it comes as a board. And the reason I say this is because we own the railroad, the state of North Carolina. We are the state of North Carolina. We own the majority shares of the North Carolina Railroad.
I had no idea.
Oh, a little thing. You pick up when you work for the state of North Carolina. So I would encourage, the legislature has to approve the people that get on the board of directors. So I would encourage us to sort of monitor this, because my thing, having been in Britain, you know, you can get on a train and go somewhere. You can get on a train and go to a small town. People, you know, they take trains where they go. So we need to keep this in mind to have input at the beginning of the decision-making process and not at the end of the decision-making process. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I'd ask staff to kind of keep us informed so we can comment, if the board can agree on that.
Sure.
So that's the basic recommendation on the light rail corridor. The second staff recommendation pertains to climate change and environmental performance measures. These were not directly included in the plan's evaluation of transit service technologies. There was substantial discussion about this issue during the public review process, and staff recommends that in its technology evaluation section, the plan should include information and basic data on energy use, fuel consumption, and greenhouse gas emissions associated with various transit technologies. This is not only good planning, this is also practical, given an announcement last week by the U.S. Department of Transportation that it's revising its criteria for analyzing applications for federal funding. Previously, the application criteria were primarily weighted towards cost effectiveness only, and with the new administration, there's going to be increased weight on environmental considerations, greenhouse gas mitigation, and livability. So it's good practice for future transit plans to, you know, get in the habit of doing environmental analyses. And with respect to this recommendation, there are a number of data sources that can be drawn from to give a general picture of the various impacts of transit service technologies. For example, the U.S. Department of Energy publishes a Transportation Energy Data Book, which has energy intensities for various transit systems. So there's a lot of data that can be drawn on. Obviously, there's not time to do a complete wholesale emissions analysis, but certainly that data could be included in the comparison of general costs and characteristics of each transit service.
For lack of not having something more thorough, would it be possible to include the one you forwarded me, the transportation?
FTA report.
Yeah, there's an FTA report that breaks it down really nicely as to what the efficiencies are for each vehicle.
Yeah, I can send you that link.
Considering that a lot of the communities, you know, into this document, and this would probably facilitate our discussion of it in that it would take us further along where it's lacking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one source of a number of sources that can be consulted. The American Public Transportation Association also puts out a fact book that has information on environmental issues, and the staff report, which I see it was gobbled up, so there's no copies remaining.
Is there somebody who needs it?
If anybody else wants to see it, there's one copy up there. But the staff report does include kind of a few figures with relation to energy intensity of light rail versus bus that are taken from the Transportation Energy Data Book. And the third recommendation is that the plan should include additional language that compares the feasibility of regional transit service originating at more distant locations with the currently recommended gateway node intercept park and rides.
Jeff, let me ask a quick question. The currently recommended gateway nodes, I think, were to capture a 6-mile radius. Is that correct? And if so, where are you talking to maybe a more regional type kind of collector?
Well, one example that the plan does acknowledge is, you know, that there's this whole concurrent regional transit planning process going on between
Triangle Transit.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it acknowledges, it says in the plan, for this specific corridor, this is the 15501 corridor, it may be worth consideration to extend services into Durham rather than intercepting residents at the Chapel Hill boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to do with at least looking at, is a park and ride at the Chapel Hill Carborough boundary the best option for each gateway node, or is regional transit service that is a little bit farther away the best option? And of course, this has environmental implications. The plan proposes almost 21,000 new parking spaces to be built to service these gateway nodes, and if those are surface lots, that has stormwater implications, water quality implications, and of course, if you intercept vehicle travelers closer to their homes, that also has an emissions impact as well. One example of this is, you know, the CCX route, which serves the park and ride at the Chatham County line. That was in place to serve Chatham County residents. And then just in the past year, Chapel Hill Transit started the PX Express, which goes almost entirely to Pittsburgh. So that's an example of a more regional transit mm-hmm. service that is running along the same route as the existing park and ride.
Does that new service require as much parking on Pittsburgh, or does it depend on people catching local bus systems? Or
the new service, at least one of the stops is in the Lowe's parking lot, so it uses an existing parking lot that, you know, at peak hours, at least in the morning peak hour, is not at capacity.
People would drive to that lot, but it's they're not driving all the way up,
right,
to, you know, just south of Orange County.
And some people might walk there. So I mean.
Right.
It's possible to walk to the bus stop in Pittsburgh now.
That's a good thing.
So this doesn't necessarily mean that regional transit service is better than park and ride and for every gateway corridor, but it should at least be considered given the potential environmental impacts and the implications of assuming that there will be the amount of vehicle travel needed to serve these park and rides.
And that's one reason I think it's hard to view this plan in isolation. I mean, mm-hmm. there's so much of this regional overlap when we're looking at these park and rides or what Triangle Transit is doing or how the light rail in the other plan affects this plan. It's we have to kind of keep that in mind while we're looking at this local plan.
On the other hand, you know, clearly, well, in some directions away from the Chapel Hill Carborough area, the regional public transportation is going to be coming much faster than others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of value to if our neighbors to our west are not going to help bring public transportation from areas west of us into the Chapel Hill-Carrboro area, then, you know, park and ride may be what we have to do in order to protect our downtown streets and intersections and when Carolina North is built, there will be an increasing amount of traffic that needs to get to that point, and they can't get there by the bypass.
Right.
They're going to have to go through downtown Carrboro or down Homestead Road or up South Columbia Street or Merritt Mill Road or something. But all of those are very difficult travel corridors already. So I think it's a good, the third point is a good comment back on the study. But on the other hand, let's say, you know, I think we just got to do what we've got to do to look out for Carrboro's interests in this process. And that probably will involve, at least in the short term, more park and ride at the edge of town, at least on our west side. Dan, you wanted to update us about
are you done?
Yes.
We discussed this process at the Transit Partners this morning, and there's a couple things I want to share. One, as Jeff already alluded to, there was clarification that all the comments being made now by citizens and advisory boards and whatnot are going to go back to the Transit Partners, and that we're going to look at how to integrate those into the plan. And there's a lot of basically the attitude on the body is that this plan has to work for all three partners, and so we need to put our heads together to get everyone's concerns addressed. The second point is, and I think this will be heartening to everyone in Carrboro because of our concern and interest in the potential for rail service, but the university representative made the point that the reason the MLK BRT is such a high priority in the draft plan was because of the anticipated schedule of Carolina North. And you'll recall that a year and a half ago they had potential funding for the law school, the Innovation Center, millions of dollars for infrastructure and design, all of which was pulled back by the state. And she actually said, well, we really need to rethink the priorities in light of that, because Carolina North's going to come along much more slowly than they had anticipated. And I think what that means for us is, well, two things. One is that, in fact, we will rethink priorities. And the other is that if that corridor is, we have more time to define the solution, it means that things can change over time. Like what we just heard from Jeff about the federal attitude toward environmental impacts, that's, you know, brand new. And I think we'll be hearing more of that in the years to come. And that's a point I made to our partners this morning in regard to the plan, is that, you know, the current draft seems very static. It doesn't really reflect the kind of flexibility that it needs to demonstrate over time as technologies are going to change and funding is going to change and et cetera. So anyway, I thought those were two important factors worth sharing. And I guess while I have the floor, I want to thank Jeff and Trish primarily. I thought you guys did a great job summarizing at least what I've been hearing from citizens and the advisory boards, and also putting it in a context that really makes sense in terms of how to move forward with the plan we have and improve it to something that's really going to be expressive of Carrboro. And I guess a lot of those people who comment are here tonight, so maybe I don't know if any of you are planning to speak and will either confirm or contest that notion that they did a good job. But thank you. And
yeah, thank you guys too. It's really good.
Thanks, Jeff. I'd also like to not only thank Trish and Jeff, but also thank the citizens who worked hard on this, because I know that the citizens and the advisory boards, you know, really
gave us things to think about and worked with us. So.
And I guess I'll just say that if there's citizen comments and we need to refer to the map of the service concept, we have it right here.
Yeah, so. You can just leave that up for the moment. That'd be good. Okay.
Jeff, one last comment that I wanted to make sure. You had mentioned that, I think it was the second slide, UNC, the way it's set up, the rail corridor wasn't necessarily going to Carolina North, I guess because it's currently oriented towards MLK. Is that correct?
Well, I think
that... Is that what that meant?
I think that pertains to the site plan for Carolina North being more... oriented towards MLK.
So what you were saying is under that could existing. Potentially change considering funding is...
Well, that could, and also the availability of technologies like that. Right. Sammy sent me this thing today of, what was it called?
It's like a bus.
I forget the name. It's basically a bus. It's a concept I think everyone's familiar with, but it's being developed in Japan, which is a bus that has both steel wheels and rubber wheels and very easily moves from a track to a street, and that's the kind of thing that potentially answers the question of, you know, how does rail service interface with the current Carolina North plan? Well, the simple factor solution would be, well, you get off the tracks, drive on your tires through Carolina North, and then get back on the tracks in some fashion.
Did any of you come to speak? I don't have anybody signed up, I don't believe, but does anybody have any thing to add?
I was stunned at the planning board's disquiet because they talked about it a lot. No, I enjoyed it, so, you know.
They did that.
Okay.
One thing I think that I feel like keeps being brought up is a kind of a frustration with public input from the beginning of processes, and my understanding is that this is the end of this one, and now we're going to do the one for 5 years from now. And that hopefully that in the next iteration, we could actually start in a public discussion using this document to inform the work that goes forward from there. So I don't know if that's something to be incorporated into this current plan to assure that it does happen like that, or how to do that.
That's a good point. Another thing I didn't mention was that the kind of next step after this plan is adopted is for Chapel Hill Transit to begin working on the short-range transit plan. And that plan will be based to some extent on the long-range transit plan. So once that planning process is started, it might be a good idea at the beginning of that process to kind of input on what that plan's goals and what recommendations and the methodology that's going to be used they're talking about a comprehensive route analysis for that plan. So the short-range transit plan is the next big planning step for the transit partners.
And that's a five-year plan, correct?
Is that I believe so, yes.
Okay. It's like Russian dolls, like the triangle plan and the Chapel Hill and then the local plan. I just hope that there's just as much information going up as there is coming down because the sequence is from big to small. You know, so we have to make sure that language continues.
Will if it's nested.
Okay.
Thanks, Jeff.
Is there a motion on this item?
Yes, do we have a do we have a resolution with that, sir?
I guess I was thinking along the lines of this is supposed to be our feedback. Is that right? To the
yeah, I guess I'll move the resolution with the resolution. Well, it includes the attached staff report be submitted with this.
Does that include I'll move that the transportation advisory board pieces too?
Well, the staff recommendation is informed by those.
Oh, okay.
So, we could attach those.
I mean,
what
you just moved is the three items that the
right. Basically, it's a resolution that's in our packet.
I would like to make sure that some of the recommendations from the Transportation Advisory Board are included or acknowledged.
Could you state specifically?
So there's the, I think that the recommendations from staff does encompass their first one, the light rail transit one. It asks for an alternative analysis so that when considering MLK corridor, the rail corridor is also considered. But the one I don't see reflected is the road diet recommendation on MLK.
What is it?
So it says the Transportation Advisory Board recommends that a road diet be implemented on MLK Boulevard to convert the two outer lanes to bus and bike only lanes. And this would give buses more capacity without additional roadway construction costs and make it clear that cars will not be accommodated at the expense of alternative forms of transportation.
Can I make a friendly amendment?
No, I have a question for after your
well, let's hear his question. It may
well, my question is, you know, in making, I think that's a great idea, but, you know, do we view our relationship with Chapel Hill as do we want their input on our road decisions, and right. You know, how do we see our, you know, because that's not really, I mean, it's connected to the transit, but it's really how they view the future of MLK, and they had a lot of discussion in the committee about wanting to keep that road as narrow as possible and ways to improve that. And
maybe it would be more appropriate to suggest that option be evaluated. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's more for the Chapel Hill Town Council to decide.
Would this hold true for the third one, the campus-to-campus bike route?
Why don't we broaden?
That doesn't have a role in this plan.
Why don't we recommend that the road diet be considered for all the high investment corridors?
Sure. Yeah.
So that way, you know, it's more inclusive. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, what I was going to suggest is that.
That's good, dude.
That because I know the planning board spent a good deal of time coming up with some questions they thought should be sort of thought about when making transportation decisions. I would just ask that they be attached. It's not necessarily, I mean, it's a public record, and I just ask that they be forwarded mm-hmm. and attached. Yeah. Because I think mm-hmm. it sort of informs sort of what the basis for the Carver thinking is. And so.
Well, yeah, I accept that as a friendly amendment
okay,
for sure.
Go.
All right.
Okay.
So let me just go back to the campus to campus because that that's something that goes along with the use of the northern southern rail corridor. And in that sense, I thought that it was important and because I want to be able to advocate for support for it.
Okay. I mean, this is a transit plan, I guess, is what I'm looking at rather than.
Well, but I mean, if you're...
It's not a multimodal.
Yeah, this isn't
plan
a bike plan. It's a transit plan.
I think
but I just see, I see that as
public
part of it.
It's not... I mean, we could recommend incorporating the blue bike program. That would be public transit.
I guess what I'm saying is it's a plan for the future of Chapel Hill Transit. So...
But we are part of Chapel Hill Transit.
But in as
but
much
I don't
as
think the campus to campus bike run, route is a part of Chapel Hill Transit, if you see what I'm saying.
I do, but it you could make an argument that it is because if you have more people riding bicycles, then there might be a shift to where you want to put some money
But where do you end that? Why isn't any bike route?
And it's not like
way?
We haven't endorsed the concept.
It's
already.
True.
I'm not expressing opposition to the campus to campus.
I'm expressing
opposition to putting it in the transit plan, yes.
Well, no. Well, the reason I think it should be there is because it's another place to say that this is part of that larger picture.
Well, why are you selecting just that one bike route
well, because
out of all the bike routes?
Why don't we have a compromise and making an attachment?
Yeah, well, that'll be fine.
Yeah. All right, there.
Okay.
Yeah,
just, okay.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
And just wanted to make sure that it's expressed that there was a James Carnan brought up the problem with the master, or I don't know, I mean, you pointed out the master planning process and how important it is for the land use vision being thought together with the transportation planning. So
It's part of the attachment, though, that the planning board.
It would be in there.
Which.
The comment is there.
Right, the comment is there.
Charlie Howland seemed like he wanted to.
The campus to campus bike connection will be brought up again. That's part of something that the Chapel and UNC have agreed to. And so UNC is researching that as part of their plan. And we're going to bring that up again. It does not necessarily have to be part of this because they're looking at different corridors to do it. And one that we're recommending is to go along with the existing rail corridor. Mm-hmm. The two of them could be related to each other to maintain that in some way. But this topic is going to be brought up again directly as they try to find a solution somewhere around the next 3 years.
Well, I do agree that that makes sense in terms of, as we're looking at the rail corridor, that the fact that the rail corridor has the potential for as a multimodal corridor is important.
Mark, I was just going to say, and to the extent that the plan addresses the gateway nodes having the transit-oriented residential and commercial mix, and I'm assuming that when we continue, as we explore our northern Carborough plan, that gateway that's found in Carborough, that'll be something that we explore when we're developing that plan in terms of land use planning.
Yeah, and we actually have a model that the consultants developed for us, and this is one of the many interesting parts of that process for me, which was, you know, we came to one meeting and it's like, well, here's this place in Chapel Hill and this place in Chapel Hill where we have sample, where we've developed transit-oriented development concepts. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, where's the place in Carborough? So we have that.
Right.
And it's for a Homestead Road property. But, yeah, and hopefully that will be helpful when we get to it.
Good.
That 7 on the map is just meant to be a kind of a placeholder for
a
wide variety of possibilities in that whole general area.
Did anyone second my motion?
I'll second it if nobody else.
I think, yeah. Okay.
Joel, you're so kind.
It's been moved and seconded. Moved by Dan, seconded by Joel. How can it not be adopted unanimously? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. All right. Mr. Manager, did you have any staff? Anything? All right. Dan.
Yeah, this is an idea that came to mind while observing the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday yesterday, which I want to run by you guys and see what anyone thinks, which is that I think there are a lot of good historical and traditional reasons why the morning rally is at the Franklin Street Post Office. But we have the centennial of Carborough coming up, and I was thinking that the possibility of, for 1 year, to look at Carborough's role in the civil rights struggle and the commitments this town has made and the issues we face by perhaps starting the rally at Town Hall and going from there to from here to the church might be worth exploring. And, you know, I don't know if the people who lived through that history and had the protests on Franklin Street and all wouldn't really, you know, might not like that idea, but I wanted to see what you all think
about
it.
This is the time to, a whole year in advance, to engage them about it.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I can...
Let's not be the ones who are coming in at the end of the planning process.
Right. No, but this is a good time. I mean, you know, 364 days away.
Exactly.
No, it's not a bad idea to entertain.
Exactly. All right.
Okay.
I would like to have a motion to maybe formally say that we're going to open up such dialogue, issue such an invitation to
that. I will move that.
I'll second that.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we initiate some dialogue with the organizers of the MLK observance for next year about the possibility of beginning in Carborough. All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Else?
Yeah, one last thing. The email I sent y'all earlier about James Hansen coming on February 1st to Memorial Hall, I'm just hoping that the town would be able to promote it over at least a couple of venues, like over the town's listserv, letting advisory committee members know about it. And perhaps if the board is willing to write a letter to the editor, I don't know if that's possible.
You could for us.
Okay.
If you give some suggested language.
Yes.
Definitely. And then maybe even encouraging neighboring governmental and semi-governmental entities and local officials to go, because it is a very comprehensive subject and encompasses all jurisdictions.
You know, you don't even have to write a letter, because you just have to send an email, and you can piss someone off when you do it. It'll be in the news.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's
just say something controversial. Okay.
Is that a possibility?
Is that a motion?
Yeah.
Yeah, motion to direct staff in that direction. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passing unanimously. Thanks.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Second. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any news from that?